Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Renee's Heart to Heart. I'm glad you joined me today. I heard a lot of terrible news again today on the television, and it always hurts my feelings when I hear so much bad stuff. A mom who leaves her, I don't know, 5 or 6 month old baby in the trunk of the car, laying on a pair of clippers and other miscellaneous tools and chemicals and stuff because she doesn't have a car seat. And the man that they've arrested but hasn't told him where the college student is that they think he kidnapped. It's not good, you know, it's not good, all the news we hear every day. And we talk about a lot of it on Renee's Heart to Heart in hopes of putting some rationalization to it or kind of take away the harshness because we talk about it and get past it. I know there's a lot of people like Shelley and I out there who get personally hurt by other people's actions. And a lot of times, if you just absorb that and leave it with you, it hurts you. So that's one of the reasons I bring up all these things and we talk about them, because they're there. You know, it's worse than the kind of hoarding that we talk about when you leave those kind of feelings inside of you and never talk them out, weaken them a little bit with conversation, try to understand a little bit. And I know some of them are totally, completely ununderstandable, but we still talk about them. So last night when I was, I wanted to do something with a little bit more positivity today. I liked what we did yesterday, although some of the things that were shared with us gave me more fuel for worry. And but I ran across this story about Sir Richard Branson. And I had seen him on an interview on television, on one of the, I don't know, it might have been even the Today Show. And he's a very, very wealthy man to the tune of, I don't know, like $60 billion is his net worth, something along those lines. And I thought, what's the deal with him? You know, I mean, we all watched Donald Trump on TV with you're fired thing and trying to show people how he became a multi-million dollar heir to, not heir, he made it all himself, a multi-million dollar financier who owns hotels and Trump Towers and all these kind of things. So I thought the show was silly. Didn't make me find a whole lot of respect. So when I saw this guy, I listened to the interview, and then I kind of Googled him last night and looked up things about him. And he's right up my alley. Right up my alley. So I want to bring Shell in so we can talk about this gentleman. I hope she knows who he is. I didn't talk to her yesterday. Good morning, sweetie. How are you?
Well, good morning, Rainey. I'm doing real good, and you?
Good, good. I'm good. Do you know who Sir Richard Branson is, honey?
Okay. I actually have a picture of a heart-shaped island that he owns that I was just mesmerized by. I had gotten this magazine, I was flipping through, and there was a picture of an island that looks like it's a heart. And I have this thing about heart. I see hearts in the clouds sometimes or things like that. So whenever I see anything that's heart-shaped that's not supposed to be a heart, it fascinates me. And this is an island that's like a perfect heart shape. It's just beautiful. And then when I read it, you know, and he's got his own private dock on there, and he's got a little landing strip. But it's very small. You could actually, from the aerial view, you could actually see the building on it. It's very, very small. It maybe is 15 acres or 15 or 20 acres, and that's the whole island. But it always impressed me, and I remembered that was owned by Sir Richard Branson, and I had heard about him a little bit in some of the circles that I was traveling, because he is one of the super wealthy on Earth. But the one thing I will say about Donald Trump, just to correct you on something, Donald Trump is not a self-made millionaire. He inherited his father's wealth. No.
Oh, he
inherited
Huh? I thought he was self-made.
No. He inherited his father's wealth.
But didn't he lose his whole fortune and then build it right back up again?
Yeah, but because it's a game to him. He looks at money different than you or I. So for him to go bankrupt in a business is meaningless to him, because he never lost anything. He didn't lose his home. He wasn't destitute out on the street. It's all a big game. He's the only person, I think, in modern history that ever bankrupted two casinos. I mean, how do you bankrupt a casino? It's like impossible. But he always rebounded from these things, because money is literally a game to him. He understands how money works because he was brought up with that wealth mindset. And he can lose it and then a week later go into another venture and have it all back again. He has the connections. And, you know, for somebody who would be considered, you know, like middle class or something like that, for somebody like that to go bankrupt, they really are destitute. They really have lost everything. But when you're talking about somebody who is as wealthy as him to lose his fortune, it's different. He really didn't go bankrupt in the sense where he was destitute and out on the street, because he still had connections, he still had ways of rebuilding, and he did. You know, he did it several times over. But he actually inherited his father's. I think the hotels that he had were actually his father's. So he was getting all that residual money from rental properties every month, and that's how he just expounded on that. And he took that money and he bought more properties and all that. So he was never a self-made millionaire, and that's one of the reasons why there are people that started in middle class and just made the right type of investments or good deals or opened a company that then became very, very successful. There are self-made millionaires, but he was not one of them, just to clarify that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, as I said, I didn't know about his birthright, but I did know that according to statistics, he went bankrupt or claimed bankruptcy and then rebuilt it. I was more or less referring to that part because I really didn't know anything about his early life or what kind of family he came from. He's not my favorite person, for what that's worth. I mean, I don't know him personally. I just, I don't know. There's just something about him that makes me feel like he's, I don't know, like he's not the nicest guy you're ever going to run into, and I could be wrong. God knows I could be wrong. But right. because of that, I've never paid much attention to his stuff, you know.
Yeah, I don't know him personally either, but I know somebody who knows him personally, who's actually sat in an office with him and talked to him, and he says that he thinks his persona in the media is funny, so he doesn't try to fix it. But that he is very, very almost nonchalant about money, because it's always come to him so easily, and because he can lose it and remake it, it really is a game to him. And he says he has respect for him because his mind works like that, because he can remake a fortune so easily because of his attitude towards money. So he said you got to respect the guy that can do that. He is very generous within his circle. He's very generous to people, very kind to people. But he said he has this gruff public persona, and he doesn't care about it. So, you know, he doesn't
do
anything.
Well, and that's certainly his prerogative. But, see, now I have never, in, like I said, I don't research him because he's not my favorite person. But
right.
I have never, by accident, reading about anything, seen anything about his being kind or his giving or anything like that. As a matter of fact, there were times when, like Sandy, Hurricane Sandy, I could not believe, I never lived in New York City or in New Jersey, but having seen what happened here after some of the hurricanes we've had here, probably the worst one that I remember is Andrew. And it was the first hurricane that the United States had that was so devastating in a long time. And a lot of money was wasted, Shell. A lot of money was wasted. I mean, they bought all those trailers. You remember that? And put them in a place in Homestead or Kendall or someplace like that. They're still sitting there. Nobody ever used them.
That's unbelievable.
According to my sources. And things like that. So when Sandy happened, and because of Facebook, social network, a lot of people that I knew from being guests at the Institute, and for other reasons, but a lot of them guests from the Institute, were devastated by Sandy if they lived in Jersey and lost homes and everything. And I kept waiting for people like Trump. I mean, that's their stomping grounds. I kept waiting for some of them to step in and make a difference. They did write in the city of New York, things happened very quickly, but on the outskirts, I mean, one woman sent me something. It was a month before anybody even came to look at them to see how devastated they were because they were so caught up. And, of course, because I don't know the circumstances, there may be good reason. But it's I don't know. When I know somebody sitting there who can make a difference and they don't, it just irks me, I guess. It just is what it is. So anyway, when I watch this guy, he has a very relaxed kind of comfortable demeanor. So when I listen to some of the interview, he is organizing a way, or he's already done it. He's not organizing it. He lets his top-notch associates, his employees, work whenever they want to and vacation whenever they want to. And he, of course, he's from, I believe he's from the UK, but he says that if you treat them like you want to be treated, what does that sound like, that they will love their job, care about you, and be, like, more productive than anybody else. And you know that I believe that. You know that that's exactly the way I feel about it. And I loved some of the things he said. And he started out when he was like, what I read didn't tell me that they had a lot of money, but it appears as though they were comfortable. He's 2 years younger than I am. And he is the founder of the Virgin Group, which comprises more than 400 companies. But at the age of 16, his first business venture was a magazine called Student. And in 1970, he set up a mail-order record business. In 1972, he opened a chain of record stores. Now, that means in 72, he was 22, later known as Virgin Megastores. Branson's Virgin brand grew rapidly during the 80s as he set up Virgin Atlantic and expanded the Virgin Records music label. According to the Forbes 2012 list of billionaires, Branson is the sixth richest citizen of the United Kingdom, with an estimated net worth of $4.6 billion. Now, later, as I read down there, I find much higher numbers. But he was born in London. Okay, so here it is. His father was a barrister, Edward James Branson, and his mother was Eve Branson. His grandfather, the Right Honorable Sir George Arthur Harwin Branson, was a judge of the High Court of Justice and a privy councillor. He was educated at Skateliff School until the age of 13, and then he attended another school until the age of 16. He has dyslexia and had poor academic performance as a student, but later discovered his ability to connect with others. on one of Branson's last days at school, his headmaster, Robert Drayson, told him he would either end up in prison or become a millionaire. Branson's parents were supportive, of his endeavors from an early age. When 15-year-old Richard decided to breed budgies and persuaded his father to build a huge aviary, his father built it. Branson's parents have been described as encouraging. So it doesn't sound like he came from a lot of money, but it sounds like he came from a comfortable home. He started his record business from the crypt of a church where he ran the student magazine. And
wow.
He advertised his records there, and he did trading. And then he opened a record shop. And some of the names of the people that he... controversial bands such as the Sex Pistols and Culture Club. There's one that we all know.
Remember Culture Club? It was Boy George, right?
Right, that was Boy George. And some all instrumentals. And he purchased a gay nightclub called Heaven. And in a consortium with David Frost, he made the unsuccessful bid for three ITV franchise under the CPV-TV name. In the early 1980s also saw his only attempt as a producer on the novelty record Ba Ba Black Sheep by singing Sheep in association with Doug McLean and Grace McDonald. I kind of remember something about that, singing Sheep. The recording was a series of Sheep Ba-Baing, along with the drum machine, produced track and reached number 42 in the UK charts in 1982.
I got it. Funny.
But to keep his airline company afloat, he sold the Virgin label to EMI for $5 million. Branson said that he wept when the sale was completed because the record business had been the very start of the Virgin Empire. He later created V2 Records to re-enter the music business. So, I mean, he's not just been entrepreneurial. He's been kind of funny. I mean, really cutting edge stuff, and has still been incredibly successful. But
his island that
is.
The island I was talking about is called Make Peace Island, and it's a miniature resort off the shores of Australia, and he charges the rate to stay there starts at $7,900 per night.
Well, I mean,
you go there, if you Google Make Peace Island, it's gorgeous. It's absolutely beautiful. Like I said, it looks like it's maybe only about 20 acres in totality. It's right off the shores from the mainland, but you can only get there by boat. There's no bridge or anything. You can only get there by boat or by plane, and it's amazing.
Well, he said, and apparently he loves the stuff he does, and that's another sentiment that has been shared with me by a lot of successful people. If you do what you love, money will come. And if you love what you do, you're good at it. So in February of 2009, the Virgin organization were reported as bidding to buy former Honda Formula One team. Branson later stated an interest in Formula One, but claimed that before the Virgin brand became involved with Honda or any other team, Formula One would have to develop a more economical, efficient, and environmentally responsible image. At the start of 2009, Formula One, on the 28th of March, it was announced that Virgin would be sponsoring the new Braun GP team, with discussions also underway about introducing a less dirty fuel in the medium term. See, this is a really open mind, don't you think? I mean, this is really somebody who's thinking really and truthfully outside of the box. with discussions underway about the less dirty fuel at the end of the season and the subsequent purchase of Braun GP by Mercedes-Benz, Branson invested an 80% buyout of Manor Grand Prix, with the team being renamed to Virgin Racing. So he's that's Airlines Racing Records. He's has a culinary center. He says the development spearheaded by Branson and Bob Wojewicz sits on 500 acres, which was the former estate of the King of Morocco. Then he did balloon racing. I mean, he's just done everything. But what brought me to wanting to talk about him is the way he treats others. And when Spike came, my son, came in here last night and said, what are you going to do the show about? We talked about it, and I told him about this guy. And he said to me, so he says to everybody, you can work any hours you want, but, and I expect you to get the job done. If the job isn't done right, then you don't have a job anymore. And I said, no, that's the whole point. He's not like a scorpion. He doesn't walk up to you face first and tell you things and then turn around and sting you. No, I listen to him. He doesn't say anything negative, Shell. He talks about, do you really like this job? Yes. Do you enjoy what you're doing here? Yes. Okay, you do your job. He doesn't make a threat after he says that. He doesn't say, and if you don't, or if you can't, then don't let the door hit you in the ass. He doesn't do that. Now, I know, after being a manager for so many years, that there are some people that you couldn't do that with. I know that. So, in truth, though, if you're really a good manager, you know that when you hire them or within days of hiring them. But if you leave somebody in a good place like that and let them know that you trust them, and that he said the United States is the worst place in the world for vacations and downtime, and yet our statistics show that most of the people we know don't ever take their vacations. Because why? Do you know why that is?
What does he mean by the worst place? Does he mean to take them, or because people don't take them? What does he mean by that?
He means that the United States, or the way we run businesses, do not support the staff, do not support the employees.
Oh, okay, okay.
They get
very little
vacation time, and the insecurity of a job place is so great, people that are high-end are afraid to take vacation because they think they're going to be replaced or somebody's going to do a better job.
Right, right.
And you and I can relate to that firsthand because, we saw that transition, right?
Yep.
But when I thought to myself.
And one of my favorite speakers, Brendan Burchard, in fact, this is something that I'm writing about, and I already have two sequel books to my first book coming out, so that's one of the reasons I'm having a hard time finishing, because I have certain topics that are coming up that aren't really appropriate for the first book, so I actually have bits and pieces of two other books that are going to be either sequels or companion books or whatever, because it's sort of the same stuff, but it's now going too far afield from the main topic. And one of them is about vacation and traveling, even if you don't spend any money. It's imperative to have downtime, and people think they can't afford it, and people think that they can't do this and they can't do that. But even if you take a long weekend once in a while and you get a hit for the money you're down, it will eventually benefit you, because when people get burned out, they get so sick that now they don't have a day or two downtime. They have weeks of downtime or months of downtime, or because they're so used up and downtrodden, their relationships fall apart. So the toll of giving into stress and putting undue pressure on ourselves and never doing anything to uplift ourselves, never doing anything to just shut down for 24 hours is really, really hazardous to us. And I experienced that. So I know firsthand that it's true and what it does to us. And Brendon Burchard in all of his lectures, and he's a high performer, a go-getter. He'll sometime go 3 weeks straight on like 4 hours sleep a night and to get a project done, but then he shuts down. He'll shut down for 2 days or for a week, or he'll take his family somewhere for 10 days, and he shuts his cell phone off. His office can't get in touch with him. He knows that he's got capable people there that can deal with anything, and he literally disconnects. And now I don't know that anybody can go that far initially, but even if you shut down for 2 days or 3 days or 24 hours, we as human beings need to press that reset button sometimes and just get away from the hecticness of our day-to-day life. And if we never do that, even for 24 hours, it just builds and builds and builds until our health or other circumstances force us to shut down, and usually in a way that's not pleasant.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the point he makes. And you know, the truth is anything that you're doing, right, anything, is served if you're fresh. I mean, you can bust your butt for weeks on end to finish a job or a project or something like that. And you get immersed in it, your energy level is high, especially if you love what you do, especially mm-hmm. if you're proud of what you do. It's that that old adrenaline thing, and it kicks in. And the first festival that we ever did at the Institute, we'd never done it before. It was a big project with no money, I might add. And our staff that didn't work on the day of the festival came in and worked and didn't clock in. Why did they do that? Because they knew that me and Michael and you and a few other people were so excited about doing this that they got caught up in the excitement.
Mm-hmm.
Now they all have to take another day off during the week so that they're there on Saturday. Because they don't get extra pay, they don't do it for nothing, so they lose one of their other days. So, and that's the way corporate usually works here in the United States. But they were more than willing back in the day to make the festival successful. And it didn't matter that they didn't get paid for that day. It didn't matter. And we saw that happen a lot of times. I remember times when we had a deadline to have a house finished. And we didn't make everybody change. We stayed up all night and worked all night long.
Yep.
Study. You know, housekeepers, maintenance teams, me, stayed up all night long so that the house was ready for a Sunday check-in. And I knew then as I know now. And I've known, I guess, my whole life. Because it was the same for me in the restaurant business. It was the same for me after Hurricane Andrew in the hotel I was working in. I loved my staff. They knew I loved them. If I said I need you, they were there.
Exactly.
And that's the point Richard is trying to make, I believe. And he's right. Now, is there going to be, every now and then, is there going to be somebody who just can't keep up with the music? Yes. You know? Yes, there is. But
you know, when you're working for somebody that you care about and that you respect, it when you extend yourself, even when you overextend yourself, it has a different effect on your physical and emotional health than when you're working for a boss that's a tyrant that you fear and that you go in every day with your stomach in knots thinking this is the day that you're going to be asked to go home and not come back. The stress working for that type of tyrannical boss is awful. It tears a person down. It turns them into a nervous wreck. And then what it does is it inspires behavior that is not nice, because when you make someone so fearful that they're going to lose their job for every little thing that goes wrong, when they do make a mistake, they're going to try to push it off on somebody else because they're so terrified of losing their job. So you actually create dissension, you create sneakiness, and it surprises me, because I've seen bosses like that, and I just recently worked for somebody like that. It surprises me that they don't understand that being that tyrannical, being that unkind and actually mean at times, actually brings out the worst in their employees. Their mindset is that it keeps them in check. No, it doesn't keep them in check. If anything, you're creating a bigger atmosphere to have people do things to you, because if they don't like you, they justify doing things that benefit them, even if it hurts you. But if somebody likes you, if somebody respects you, if somebody thinks that their boss is a really terrific person, they're going to try harder to please that individual because they want their positive attention. And they will work harder and experience less stress working for that type of boss. So Richard Branson has it down pat. We had talked on the show one day about the book about the Ritz-Carlton. The way they deal with their staff is very uplifting. And again, you're creating a staff that they have a lower turnover than a lot of other hotel chains, because their staff is paramount to them. And because they treat their staff so well, their staff then in turn treat their guests very well, which gives them their reputation. And that's what it's all about. And I've seen that staff members that work under tyrants are usually very, very poorly behaved. They have terrible ethic problems. A lot of times they will justify doing things that are wrong, and they're always for for things that benefit themselves only. And
right.
But I've also people that work in an environment where everybody, there's a lot of camaraderie, where there's respect and caring about the boss, and totally different. First of all, there's less stress in them. Even when they're working hard, even when they're going days on end trying to finish a project, the stress level is minimal because they're in an environment where they know that they're truly cared for and that they have an open voice to say what they need to say. And those are some major, major issues today in the workplace.
Well, and you know that's what I believe, and you... you know that, you know, everything we talk about, life is too short. If you're finding fault in everybody, getting mad at everybody, being hurt by everybody, you literally need to stop and smell the roses. I mean literally.
Mm-hmm.
The truth of the matter is, very few people... We have a tendency to think that if anything doesn't go the way we wanted it to go, it's because somebody is actually doing something against us. When the truth of the matter is, they're not even thinking about you, honey. They're thinking about themselves. It has nothing to do with you most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Who, you know, there was... I can't remember how it went, but it tickled me. It was something about you walk into a party all dolled up, you know, and you think you look great, and you notice that everybody's staring at you, and you start feeling, you know, intimidated by it. And the bottom line was they're not looking at you. They're looking to see if you're looking at them, because all they're thinking about is them. Amen. Amen.
That's good. I like that.
Isn't it the truth, though? You know,
yes,
you go in and, you know, am I impressing everybody? No, they're looking to see if you're impressed by them.
Yep.
So all that
it
pressure
is?
You put on yourself isn't even there.
Mm-hmm.
No, it isn't even, it's all in your head. And when somebody does something that upsets you or affects you in a negative way, many times I'm going to say, every now and then, I'm sure people do negative things to upset somebody else. I know that. But as a rule, it's about something positive for them. The fact that negativity falls to you is a side effect, an unfortunate side effect, but nonetheless not the driving catalyst to do what they did. They did what they did because it's going to help them, put them in a better place. I'm reminded of a story of close associates working hand in hand in a place, and things get real bumpy at this workplace, and insecurities start popping up, as they will in the workplace, when you see that things are not going the way you know they should be going, and you're afraid that maybe somebody thinks it's your fault. So what do you do when that happens, Shell? If you're a really insecure person, what do you usually do?
You start finding fault with other people to take the emphasis off of you.
Exactly. So I can't tell you how many times that happens. I've watched it happen afar. I've watched it happen personally. And ultimately, if you're feeling that insecure and you feel guilty of something, you probably are in trouble. I made that statement many years ago. Somebody said to me, isn't it hard to, you know, let people go, to, you know, take away somebody's livelihood and stuff like that? And I say, I don't really do that. They do that to themselves.
Right.
They did their job the way they promised me they would. They don't lose their job.
Right.
You know, they get promoted. They make more money. I don't think, honestly speaking, Shelley, that I have ever let anybody go that didn't know before I did that they weren't doing a good job.
Exactly.
Right? So if you take that person, you're running a big business, and you take that person, and you still see a shining light in that person. You still see something that's worth saving. And you bring that person in, and you say to them, you know, this is hard for you. You're not doing a good job at this. And God knows I've had these conversations many, many times. And they say, you're right. I don't like doing this. Can you move me someplace else? Well, where do you think you'll fit better? I would love to work in the kitchen. Or I would love, one of my favorite stories was somebody who was very sad and was going to quit. They were a massage therapist, and they started having so much trouble with their hands and their wrists, because being a steadily working massage therapist and doing anywhere from 6 to 8 massages, an hour long each one, every day, 5 to 6 days a week, takes a toll on your hands and your wrists and your arms. And this person came to me, I don't think I can do this anymore. I've been to the doctor, I've got like tendonitis in my wrists and everything. I don't know what to do, I may have to quit. And I said, why don't you be another kind of a therapist? And they said, well, like what? I'm not good at talking to people. I don't want to do that. I don't want to, and, you know, that takes more of an education. I have my masseuse license, and I, you know, that's what I thought I'd want to be. But now, you know, this person by this time was approaching 50, just still very young. She said proudly after her 66th birthday. You know, we sat there talking, and I said, what about a colon therapist? Could you do that? And she said, I think I could. Now that person is still incredibly productive, one of the best colon therapists I know, and saved her career. Now, I was getting complaints. I was afraid I was going to have to do something already. But you see, she already knew that things were not going good. So by opening up that communication and talking, this person still has a very, very lucrative job. No more pain in her hands and her arms. That's the way it's supposed to be done. That, and that's what you do for the good people, and that's what they do for you. So recognizing them isn't all your job, you know. Recognizing them, sometimes they have to recognize themselves. So I look down and through here, and he says, Branson has stated in a number of interviews that he derives much of his influence from nonfiction books. He most commonly names Nelson Mandela's autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom, explaining that Mandela was one of the most inspiring men I have ever met and had the honor to call my friend. Owing to his interest in humanitarian and ecological issues, Branson also lists Al Gore's best-selling book, An Inconvenient Truth, and The Revenge of Gaia by James Lovelock, amongst his favorites. According to Branson's book, Screw It, Let's Do It, Lessons in Life, he also a huge fan of works by Jung Chang. In terms of fiction, Branson has long held an admiration for the fictional character Peter Pan. Wow. In 2006, he founded Virgin Comics, stating that Virgin Comics will give a whole generation of young creative thinkers a voice. Do you not just love this man, Shel?
Yep. Yeah. No, he really thinks outside of the box. And, you know, he's very imaginative. Is there anything in there? Because I think it's Sir Richard Branson, but maybe it's another one of the super wealthy. But isn't Richard Branson the one who actually wants to, like, go to the moon or something? And he's actually trying to get some sort of charter or something to go to the moon? Isn't that him? Something like that?
Yes. There's something about... I'm glad you brought that up because I was going to read about that. I think he, like, promised his son that that they would go to the moon and be some of the first people on traveling spaceships. Now I can't find that part of the. This is a big article.
All right, but it was him. Okay, I thought that it was him.
He's also been in cameo appearances around the world in 80 Days, Superman Returns, James Bond, Casino Royale. He's a Star Trek fan and is named, he has named his new spaceship VSS Enterprise in honor of the famous Star Trek ships. And in 2006, he reportedly offered actor William Shatner a ride on the inaugural space launch of Virgin Galactica, or Galactic. In an interview with Time Magazine on the 10th of August in 2009, Shatner claimed that Branson approached him asking him how much he would pay for a ride on a spaceship. In response, Shatner asked, "How much would you pay me to do it?" In 2007, he announced on the Colbert Report that he had named a new aircraft Air Colbert. He later doused political satirist and talk show host Stephen Colbert with water from his mug. Branson subsequently took a retaliatory splash from Colbert. The interview quickly ended with both laughing. So it sounds like, first and foremost, he's a pistol. Doesn't it? I mean, it sounds like he is quite
well, he's quite irreverent at one of the, and I don't know what it was for. I just remember one of the images. He's got like red lipstick on. He's got his 5 o'clock shadow. He has his hair pulled back like a lady, and he's got eyeshadow and mascara on. And I don't know what he was wearing that getup for, but he had this big like red red plumy scarf on, you know, sort of like a boa, a red boa around his neck, and he just looked outrageous. It was for some sort of an event that he was going to, and everybody was like in shock and awe when they saw him, but he's kind of like that. He's very irreverent. He likes to go for the shock factor. He's a good-looking guy, and I don't know what the purpose was of him showing up there, but it got him what he wanted. Everybody was talking about him that day.
Well, there seems to be a couple little innuendos about his sexuality, but I don't see anything that says one or the other, but that he has children, which doesn't really mean anything. But I don't know. I don't care, but he does talk about...
That'd have been his way of flaunting it today then. And, you know, like I said, I don't care either. I just think he's a fascinating individual. I think he has an extremely creative and active mind, and he has the wealth to do a lot of things that that kind of inspire us to keep pushing the limits of what we're able to do in our circles. Because there's a lot of other people that are wealthy that haven't done one-tenth of what he's done. I mean, he's constantly out there doing something.
Yeah, well, he says in 2004, he announced the signing of a deal under which a new space tourism company, Virgin Galactic, will license the technology behind Spaceship One, funded by Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen and designed by legendary American aeronautical engineer and visionary Burt Rutan, to take paying passengers into suborbital space. Virgin Galactic, wholly owned by the Virgin Group, plans to make flights available to the public with tickets priced at, in U.S. currency, $200,000, using scaled composites White Knight 2. I don't know what that means. Branson plans to take his two children, 31-year-old Holly and 28-year-old Sam, on a trip to outer space when they ride the Spaceship Two rocket plane on its first public flight planned for 2014. Well, he better hurry up if he's going to do that. 2014, almost over. But, I mean, so what have we said now? He did airplanes. He did comic books. He did books. He did records. He... trains, and of course, Virgin Atlantic is his, I guess. In June 2006, a tip-off from Virgin Atlantic led U.S. and U.K. competition authorities to investigate price-fixing attempts between Virgin Atlantic and British Airways. In August 2007, British Airways was fined $271 million over the allegations. Virgin Atlantic was given immunity for tipping off the authorities and received no fine, a controversial decision the Office of Fair Trading defended as being in public interest. Well, that's a pretty interesting paragraph, don't you think?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm not sure whatever. Yeah, that is an interesting way of closing it out.
Yeah, it is a game. We both know that. We've learned that in a lot of different arenas in different ways. But so to finish this up.
And he also has the island that I was talking about, the heart-shaped island. And it's interesting. I don't know if it was already named Makepeace Island or if he named it Makepeace Island, but that's actually the name of it.
Hmm.
And when you look at the map, it's right on the outer edge of Australia, and there's a couple other little teeny tiny islands. I mean, like I said, it's really small. When you're talking 20 acres, that's not even, it's probably not even more than maybe 5 miles across or something like that. It's really, but it's perfectly heart-shaped, which is astonishing. You know, this is a natural island. It's not a man-made island, but it's perfectly heart-shaped.
Mhm. Mhm. Well, let me read, because this is about his personal life. Branson has a daughter named Holly and a son named Sam. He stated in an interview with Piers Morgan that he and wife Joan had a daughter named Claire Sarah, who died when she was just 4 days old in 1979. The couple wed at their daughter Holly's suggestion when she was 8 years old in 1989 at Necker Island, a 74-acre island owned by Branson in the British Virgin Islands. Would that be the same one, Shell?
No. This is right on the tip of Australia. So evidently he owns more than one island. The island I'm talking about is called Makepeace Island, and it's very small. It would not be 74 acres.
Okay. In 1998, Branson released his autobiography titled Losing My Virginity, an international bestseller. Branson was deeply saddened by the disappearance of fellow adventurer Steve Fawcett in September of 2007. The following month, he wrote an article for the Time magazine titled My Friend Steve Fawcett. He says he's been influenced by nonfiction books, and I already read that. So this is quite a, I mean, and this is just condensed, you know, but it tells he's raised a whole bunch of money for charities. He's donated a whole bunch of things. In 2008, he hosted an environmental gathering at his private island, Necker Island, in the Caribbean with several prominent entrepreneurs, celebrities, and world leaders. They discussed global warming-related problems facing the world, hoping that this meeting would be a precursor to many more future discussions regarding similar problems. Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair and Wikipedia co-founder Jimmy Wales and Larry Page of Google were in attendance. Branson has been very supportive of Kenya during its troubles, and in May 2008 had gone to Masai Mara to open a new school, Sekinani Primary School, which has also been partly funded by Virgin Atlantic frequent flyers who volunteered their time to help with the construction. A documentary of the experience was directed by Carolyn Scott Hamilton and filmed by David Kalupi. On May 8th, 2009, Branson took over Mia Farrow's hunger strike for 3 days in protest of the Sudanese government expulsion of aid groups from the Darfur region. In 2010, he and the Naduna Foundation, founded by Amy Robbins, and Humanity United, an organization backed by Pam Omidar, the wife of eBay founder Pierre Omidar, founded Enterprise Zimbabwe. So he's totally active in ecological stuff, obviously space travel, a little bit of everything. But again, the reason I am enamored by this man is his thoughts on taking care of the people who are taking care of him. And I so appreciate that. And I believe that if we could get more people in line with that, we wouldn't be in so much trouble. And certainly if we could get our government in line with that.
Mm-hmm.
Get the
mm-hmm.
Yeah, that are sitting in.
Kind of astonishing yesterday. One of the facts that came out in the show yesterday that I think was the most disturbing to me of all of them with regard to identity theft was that our federal government has paid out over $50 billion in wrong tax returns. And then they're coming after the little person like me, you know, for $1,000 or $1,500 that I don't even believe I owe them, you know, and here they're just handing it out. I don't understand why there's not more of a stopgap, you know, but they'll come after somebody like me that's proven to them I don't owe them the money, and they'll just hammer and hammer and hammer. I'm sorry. My $1,500 that I don't owe you anyway isn't making a dent in the $50 billion that you paid out wrongfully because you don't know how to check a Social Security number and make sure it's not owned by a two-year-old. I just find that I find that mind-boggling. I find it irresponsible. I can't believe our government has to be aware of this issue and that our government has not done something in the background to fix it. with all these databases, there's got to be somebody out there that can take these records and say, okay, this Social Security number is owned by a 3-year-old in Oregon, and meanwhile I have a tax return from a 38-year-old in New Jersey. It obviously there's some sort of a scam going on here, or to flag 20 returns going to the same address. It's ludicrous. It's absolutely ludicrous that there's not some sort of a stopgap to prevent that. We're not talking 5,000 or even 5 million, which is an astronomical number, but 50 billion, that's unheard of.
So, Shel, you're very analytical. Have you given any consideration to, if you sat in that seat, what kind of steps you would take to start? I mean, obviously, this organization that we talked to yesterday, to protect our personal information, is a step. But what if you were sitting in a high seat in Congress? What if you were invited into a roundtable and President Obama looked at you and said, Shelley, what in the hell can we do about this? Do you realize this is going on? What are we going to do about it? Did you ever give any thought to what you'd say?
Yes. Set up a centralized database to record where a Social Security number is initiated and what the age of the individual is. And when you get a tax return, you do an instantaneous check. Let me explain what I'm talking about. I just tried to renew my Florida driver's license, and I wasn't able to because I had a ticket from New York from 1997 that I fought because I didn't believe I owed it. It was for a seatbelt. I had an injured shoulder. I wasn't able to wear a seatbelt. I explained to the cop. I showed him my injury, because I had a bandage there, and I said I can't wear the seatbelt for a couple of days, and he didn't care. He gave me the ticket anyway. I thought it was ludicrous, And so I tried to fight it, but I was moving to Florida. So I moved to Florida, and I thought that I had disputed this ticket and I wasn't going to have to pay it. Well, after I'm in Florida, I get a summons. I'm not flying back to New York to pay a ticket. I already had a Florida license. Well, now Florida and all the other states in the United States are what's called a national database. So if you commit a crime like a DWI or something like that in another state and you lose your license, you can't move somewhere else, get a license there, and just go happy about your way. Now with this national database, they're clearing that all up. So I had to contact New York, reinstate my New York license, pay the fine, which, thank God for me, was very little. And once I restored my New York driving privileges, I didn't actually have to get a new license. I just had to clear my driving privileges. Then I was able to go back to Florida and renew my license here. So I got it all taken care of. It wasn't that big of a deal for me. But I can imagine with people that might have had DWIs lingering or parking fines and stuff like that, it could have been up to thousands of dollars. For me, it wasn't. So I was able to handle it very easily. But we're talking about a driver's license, for God's sake, okay? Not getting thousands of dollars from the IRS in a fake return. I don't understand how the IRS doesn't have some sort of a national database like that for just simply Social Security numbers, since identity theft is such a major, major, major issue. And Social Security numbers, like Mark was talking about yesterday, using the Social Security number is the biggest way of stealing somebody's identity. Just with that one piece of information, you can actually create another identity. So there should be some stopgap protecting our Social Security numbers. Now they're coming out with real ID driver's licenses. Why can't they come out with real ID Social Security numbers, where it's locked in to the age and date of person, the gender, and where they're living, and protect it that way? I'm telling you it can be done, and I don't understand why the IRS isn't doing it.
Yes, it's supposed to be that way now. I mean, that's the whole idea of getting it, and all the numbers have a purpose, but obviously it's not working. But one of the things, we're out of time, but one of the things I want to say, that a lot of times all these ground rules are set and they give the people that are sitting in the chairs at the bottom of that pyramid just tasks and no power. So consequently, they do a task. I'm supposed to run through these taxes and make sure the forms are done right check the validity of this and the validity of that, it all comes up okay because you just check. You make a simple check. And if the IRS or the paychecks are written out to the Social Security number with the name Renee Brewer on it, then it's good to go. Because sitting there that is actually doing that particular part of the job has no more power to find anything else out.
That's because the database doesn't exist. That's what Mark was talking about yesterday, is that technology doesn't talk to technology. Nobody has created that Social Security database, and that's what I don't understand. It's more important for us to spend money on creating that than anything else that the IRS is spending money on right now to stop identity theft.
I agree. We got to go, though. Time is up. Everybody go out there and have a great day today. God bless. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll talk some more about everything we talked about all week. It'll be the week in review. So God bless, everybody. Have a great day. Bye-bye. Thanks, babe. Talk to you later.
Thanks, Reen. Talk to you guys in the morning.